You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. The show is brought to you in partnership with Progressive Masculinity and headteacherchat.com. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the We Lead Well podcast. I'm Vicky Maguire. I'm an education and leadership coach. I work with school leaders, supporting them to improve their own well-being and that of all their staff. I do this in a number of ways. I do leadership coaching, one-to-one coaching for staff. I support schools to create coaching communities where staff coach each other in order to improve teaching and learning. I also run group coaching programs for women leaders, and I've created the Women Lead Well Coaching Network that provides a supportive network for female school leaders. It's a shared space where women in education can come together and support each other and champion each other. It's a place where they can connect with like-minded women, share their challenges and just be reassured that they're not on their own. And at the moment, I am offering free membership of the Women Lead Well Network. Thank you to those people who have been in touch to request to join. I will look forward to welcoming you to the network. And if you would like to join, you can email me. It's vicky@weleadwell.co.uk. If you're interested in any of the other coaching opportunities that I provide, you can email me there as well. So today, I want to introduce a new sponsor for the show, and that is Schools UK. I've been a bit reluctant in the past to have a sponsor for the show, but I really believe that what Schools UK offer is amazing for well-being in your school. So they provide supply cover insurance, and they've been doing this for 24 years, and it's a family-run business. And what I love about the supply cover insurance that they provide is that they provide a well-being package alongside it. And the well-being package provides so many amazing benefits, from face-to-face counselling, and anyone in your school, on your school staff, can access that counselling, and you can have 6 face-to-face sessions. There are musculoskeletal services included, and that might be acupuncture, physio, a chiropractor. You can generally get 4 to 5 sessions of that provided for you. And they also have their employment assistance programme, and that's open to all family members of all of your staff. And that means there's 24/7 access to an information hotline, and you can get information and help with family related issues, bereavement, trauma, relationships, stress, money management. The list goes on for that. But the most brilliant part of this wellbeing package is the access that you can get to a GP, and you can get access on the day that you need the appointment. So you can go online in the morning, book your appointment and speak to a GP that very day. There are no time limits on the appointment. You can feel comfortable that you've got time to share all of the things that you need to share with the GP. And if you are prescribed some medication, the GP can get that sent to you on the day. So you will get your prescription sent out to you in the post. Now, I just think in terms of well-being for staff in schools, that is an absolute bonus that you get. And I know that lots of schools have supply cover insurance, so it's well worth looking at Schools UK, just because of the amazing well-being benefits that they provide. Now, when you go onto their website, if you decide you are going to purchase their supply cover insurance, you can add the code WELEADWELLPODCAST for a 10% discount. Now, it's a pretty amazing discount as well, so you could end up saving yourself quite a significant amount of money. So that's Schools UK. So today on the show, I have got a fantastic interview with an absolutely amazing woman, Stephanie Miller, who is the deputy head in a school in Vietnam. And Stephanie talked to me all about the importance in teaching and learning of process versus outcome, and how in her school they have really changed the focus from being outcome driven and focused on academic performance to looking more at metacognition and how you can focus more on how you learn effectively, and teaching your young people those skills so that they actually end up achieving the outcomes anyway. So I'm sure you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Steph Miller, welcome to the We Lead Well podcast. How are you today?
Hello, good, thank you. Yeah,
miles away in Vietnam.
Yeah, I don't know how many miles away, but yeah, it's evening here, whereas it's beginning for you.
Just afternoon, just about here. So yeah, yeah. It's a big difference. I don't know if the weather's that different. It's quite humid here at the minute. So
Yeah, you're talking to the wrong person. It's often kind of 20 degrees above what it actually is here. It feels like, and the humidity's mega, yeah.
Yeah, and we've got, there are huge grey clouds gathering. So I'm expecting a storm anytime. So it might interfere with... I'll be quickly closing the window if there's a storm so I don't get wet. So it's great to have you on the podcast with us today. Can you tell the listener a little bit about yourself, who you are and what you do, and how you've ended up in Vietnam being a deputy head in a school out there?
Yeah, of course. I've been here for 5 years, and I think most people that join an international school or embark on that at some point in their career think it's only just going to be for those kind of first 2 years that you commit to. And 5 years in, and despite family probably not wanting to hear this, I don't think I'll be back anytime soon. But actually that's not because I didn't have a really incredible experience in the UK. My experience teaching in the UK was incredible. I speak really positively about it. And in fact, I had such a good experience in the UK that I wanted to find a school that mimicked the same values and kind of had community at its core, and I didn't really mind where that was. And so that was the most important thing to me, but the location of it, I was really open on. And so the school I worked at in the UK was, in the south of England, a state school we sat on the edge of the Bromley Borough, but our intake came from Croydon. So we had a real mixed kind of student demographic. And the school still continues to do really well by the students that it's got, and serves the community really well. And I think it just, for me, laid a really good foundation in kind of understanding what my values are as a leader, and how I can support others to grow kind of within that remit. And then I moved over. I'm actually a DT trained educator, but actually only taught DT for a year and then moved into art education, and have led departments and faculties, and then moved into assistant head when I moved over to Vietnam, and then into deputy more recently.
So what is your responsibility as a deputy now? What is it you focus on?
I'm really kind of, I'm the only deputy. We're a growing school, so there's four of us on our leadership team in secondary. There's eight of us kind of educational leaders within the whole school. It's a through 2 to 18 school, which I really love. And I look after kind of all of the academic side of the school, really, and lead on a fair part of the kind of operational side of things. But so, you know, professional learning and curriculum and teaching and learning are kind of my main areas. But I actually just love being able to make a difference in some sort of way. And I think my background, my ability to kind of think creatively and divergently means that I'm always a bit nosy and want to get interested and involved in things and want to kind of find some solutions and help. So I end up getting involved in anything I can do, really.
I think that's the same for all of us. When we're interested in leadership and we're ambitious, we just want to do everything we can, don't we, to make a difference. Sometimes too much, maybe. Sometimes we say yes to too many things. So you mentioned values then, and you talked about how important they were to you in the school that you were working in the UK. And I'm interested in how they focus on values in an international school in Vietnam, because I think what you've said is that the parents there really value academic outcomes and achievement. So how did you find the difference between that? Because you said you were looking for a school that had the same values as you. What did you find in that school in terms of how the values system was different in the environment that you're working in?
Yeah, I think possibly I want to answer that question in two ways, if that's okay. The school that I came from had community at its centre, and it was you kind of were very much part of everything. And I went there post uni and kind of found all my new mates that became a bit like family. It was a really great experience. And so the school, though, the values matched there for me. And that was the thing that really drew me, like you definitely get the same feel in the current school. In terms of kind of my values and what I kind of really like to develop through my leadership, is something that probably started in my training. Like I had some really excellent training in becoming a DT teacher, and the training that I had encouraged us to focus on the process rather than outcomes. Yeah. And we had really great tutors that weren't interested in kind of clocks and moving toys. They didn't want outcomes where the students all had the same thing and it was kind of predetermined, but they really wanted us to dig deep on what I now know is kind of the learning journey and looking at metacognition and getting students to really understand and value the process really more than the outcome.
Yeah.
And when I got to Vietnam, I realized that our cohort and the context and the students were only ever wanting to talk about academic grades and outcomes, and kind of they were almost terrified of the process because they were fearful of making a mistake and things being wrong. So you'd look in books and they'd be perfect. There wouldn't be any kind of creative thinking. And so I actually moved over as a head of art in my first year, and I found that really interesting, just trying to explore that from a creative perspective. But then I kind of felt like I could expand that and wanted to work more whole school on that. And I really wanted to explore that with parents and teachers as well, and how we break down that kind of real focus on outcomes, which I get and I understand that they're important, but I think you can have both if you kind of hit the sweet spots, so to speak.
Yeah. So how do you incorporate that? You've mentioned a couple of these things like creativity, risk-taking, critical thinking, that sort of genuine inquiry into like your own classroom practice, but then how have you developed that so that you can do that whole school?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. I think it's really easy to upskill teachers with an understanding about process and ask them to talk around reflection and metacognition in the classroom. But I think there can be a real contradiction within your leadership approach. And I think you can really undermine the kind of messages that you're trying to share just with some really obvious or what become obvious actions when you start to think about it a little bit more. So one of the first areas we looked at was assessment and how much we were talking to them about outcomes and kind of perfect outcomes, and how we got them to engage a lot more with the process. So we now have an assessment approach at Key Stage 3, and we're an IB school, so it's a fun place to be anyway, because you have to really ensure that your students are kind of really ready for a broad curriculum. But we had to really think about how we assess them in a way that we could get them to engage with the feedback and engage with the process rather than engaging kind of with just what was on their report. And so we moved our assessment philosophy to look at three strands, and two of those strands address six skills, and they're common across the school, and they look at things like risk taking, and they look at things like communication, and willingness to kind of have a go and take risks. And that was a bit of a big shift, and I know there's a kind of a bit of a tension around what you can assess with regards to skills-based approach and what you can't, and I get it, and I'm an art educator, but actually I think that was important in saying to our parents, no, we really value this, and in fact we value it so much that we're going to we're going to put kind of out of the three areas that we're going to assess your child in, we're going to focus two of them are just going to be on skills that we think are really important in order to develop and think more about the process. And then the final section is looking at skills within certain subject areas. And then, and this extends from work that I saw play out really effectively in the UK in the school that I worked at, but we've then kind of moved that on a lot more. And we now report mainly on effort, but we've broken that down into four strands, and we look at effective effort. And in some subject areas, the students determine what they think their effort is through reflection. And in other subject areas, it's a kind of a conversation with their teachers. But visually now, and many of our parents actually can access their reports because visually we've really tried to push that on the reports rather than kind of being writing heavy. Visually now, the effort kind of takes up more space on the report than the academic side of things does. So even at IGCSE and IB, we're trying to promote and prompt those conversations at home that's more about what's happening during the process. Vicky, I can't hear you.
That's because I was on mute. Because we were talking about this before the show, the dog came in and started snuffling around. So I thought, I'm going to put it on mute so you can't hear the dog just making all these snuffling noises, and then forgot to take mute off. What I was asking was, how have you communicated that with parents? Because they probably, like you're saying, they are outcome driven. They want to know not what skills their child's got, what is my child going to achieve in this baccalaureate or IGCSE?
Yeah.
How have you navigated that? How have you communicated why you're doing this to parents so that they can understand it and accept it?
And the answer to that is, I think you have to know that you're committing to that conversation for the long haul. We kind of did a huge amount of work in the beginning and made the mistake of kind of being like, brilliant, we've covered all bases. And look at us, we've developed a really good parent program and we've delivered it in multiple languages to make sure they really understand it. And of course, then we kind of stopped talking about it for a little bit and then the conversations creep in. And so I think if you kind of really commit to this approach in this context, you can never assume that the work's done, and you have to keep going with it, and you have to make sure that, you know, all members of the community are on board with it. And teachers are kind of using it as their centerpiece for conversations in parent events and communications and things like that. And then more recently, we've engaged students with that process as well. So the Teaching and Learning Student Committee that I work closely with have been leading parent workshops on it as well. And they've been talking around effective conversations to have about effort and the best conversations that you can have with your child when you receive their academic report that will actually empower them to improve. And that's been really powerful, actually hearing from students. And we weren't sure how that might land with our community. You know, do they really want to hear from students? Do they want to hear from us? And actually in the series of workshops that we've run this year, it was the most attended was the one that was offered by students on this topic specifically.
Right.
Which has been great. So I think, you know, students are on board with it, but they'll often say to us, but, you know, there's still work to be done, and you kind of don't quite understand, Miss, the kind of pressure that we are getting at home. And so how can we move that conversation forward as well? And I think, you know, we know that metacognition and self-regulation are really important as educators. You know, I often quote the EEF toolkit, and they talk around it being one of the kind of lowest financial outputs that a school can make, but has the highest impact. And they say that, you know, schools or education environments that focus on this, students make up to 7 months more progress than their peers, and why this isn't so much of a focus. And that's a real good sales pitch to parents as well, because it's kind of like, if you come on board with this, the byproduct is that the outcomes will start to look after themselves. In fact, they'll improve, but go with us and stay with us and support us in the conversations that you're having at home as well.
There's a couple of things that have come up there for me. The first one is that you mentioned the EEF toolkit, and that refers to metacognition, but the EEF's guide to implementation, it's interesting that you say, you know, you took your eye off the ball for a bit and then you realized after a while, you know, the parents are starting to really lose that understanding of why we're doing what we're doing. So you just have to, it's about sustaining the change, isn't it? And keeping the focus on it as you move forward, and recognizing, I think, that when you get new staff into the school, it has to be part of their induction process. And when you get new students into the school, it has to be part of the process for them, introducing it to them and getting them to understand it. But also your new parents who are coming in as well, because it will be something that's very strange or alien to them, won't it? Because of like culturally what they might have experienced before with their own education, or what they feel in terms of what they want for their children. They might just not have ever experienced this process versus outcome and skills and all of the things that you're working on. So the sustaining of that change includes all of those things, doesn't it? All your stakeholders, and keeping that message consistent and keeping on going, because otherwise things fall flat on their face, don't they?
Yeah. And I think it's really easy and in schools to focus on I've lost you, Edge. I think it's really easy in schools to focus on academic outcomes, and actually, you know, my role as deputy head, yes, is academic outcomes, but if I'm looking after the process, then they should look after themselves. But I think it's really important that when you're constructing a leadership team and you're really thinking about all those responsibilities, you know, it's inevitable that any secondary school will ensure that someone is responsible for Key Stage 4 outcomes, someone is responsible for Key Stage 5 outcomes. But do we kind of survey, or do we review our responsibilities and make sure that someone has their eye on the ball for this topic specifically? Because it can, I've mentioned this earlier, but I think you can really contradict your message. So we've looked at our marketing. Like I did this a few months ago, and I was actually presenting on this similar topic at a conference, and I thought, I'm going to go back to our social media page and just see what message we're putting out to prospective parents that you just mentioned, kind of all parents. And actually, when I looked through, we'd reminded people about our IB results, and we'd reminded people about a sporting event where we'd won recently, and we'd highlighted our performing arts production, but we hadn't built in any process focus. So we were contradicting our message, really. And it was such a good discussion around the leadership table, around like, we really must make sure that this balance is being addressed everywhere. And what are we doing with people that we line manage and departments to make sure that we're showcasing both process and performance? Because otherwise we're saying we value it more highly, and actually that isn't what we're trying to say.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me was, you know, it's like, I could be focused on an outcome if I'm going to run a marathon and say, you know, I really love the outcome of a 3-hour 30 marathon. But then if I didn't put any training, I'm never ever going to run a marathon in 3 hours 30 minutes. I can assure you of that. I'm probably never going to run a marathon. I mean, never say never, but I like running, but not that much. And my knees can't take it anyway anymore. But if I didn't put the training in, if I didn't monitor where I was up to, if I wasn't, you know, being like practicing it regularly, it's just pie in the sky stuff, isn't it? I'm never going to achieve a 3-hour 30-minute marathon. So you can have as many targets or objectives for outcomes as you want, but unless you're doing the work and you're putting the processes in place and you're monitoring and you're reflecting and evaluating and, you know, shifting those things around and working on how you're getting there, that you're never going to achieve it, are you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that comes down to habits. And I think that's a really interesting topic in our conversation as well. Often we're having to kind of undo some of those habits because, you know, there is a pressure. I need to get an A star in this subject. Therefore, what am I going to do? I'm going to spend 7 hours tonight revising for that test tomorrow. And actually, that's kind of been our most recent work within teaching and learning is partnering with a consultant that comes and talks to teachers and students about the brain, about how we learn best, about chunking.
The forgetting curve.
Many languages now. Yeah, yeah. And then from that, also, you know, the well-being, I can't remember what it's called now, but our diagram for well-being as well, and how that kind of the stress graph that we've got as well, that looks at like if we're in at this stress point, then we're not going to be learning effectively, and our habits aren't going to be supporting our learning and therefore supporting high academic outcomes. So those conversations then start to kind of wrap into one another as well. And that's another big bit of work, because again, you know, there is a bit of a culture of kind of sleep and lack of sleep, and I've stayed up X amount of hours doing this piece of work.
It's a bit like teaching, that, isn't it? I stayed up till midnight last night planning for this or doing that. And then well, you're absolutely knackered the next day, so you can't deliver it effectively anyway, because you've only had 5 hours sleep and you're irritable and grouchy, and it just doesn't work, does it?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's also feedback, right? And we're kind of covering all bases here, but you know, is our feedback just summative? How often are we kind of stopping a task and checking where we're at and monitoring? And we had a teacher that had the opportunity to go to MIT last week, which was awesome. And she came back today and we were chatting today, and she said, we really need to challenge our curriculum. We need to like design to fail. We don't need to design to produce a product. We need to design to fail so we understand that we've kind of exhausted absolutely every option. And I really liked that. I kind of thought about that a couple of times today about designing to fail and how often, you know, how comfortable are our teachers with that learning process as well, I think.
I'm learning Spanish at the minute, and I'm doing it on Duolingo, and I have to do a little bit every day. And I get a lot of perfect lessons on there, and sometimes I think, this isn't really challenging me.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be able to get through a lesson and just be able to do this, because I'm not learning anything. I'm just going through, and I know there is space for going over things that you already know. I recognize that you have the forgetting curve, you have to come back to it, but you have to intersperse new learning and challenge. And it does frustrate me sometimes if there is the odd lesson where I get below 90%. I'm a bit like, bah. But actually they're the lessons where I've really had to think, you know, where I know I've had to go back and check what the word is and make sure of things and been really challenged. That's where I feel like the learning is happening. So I think you've got to encourage failure, but you've got to create an environment in which making mistakes and making learning hard is the norm. But also, just coming back to what you said, I was thinking about what you said in terms of a lot of schools take the approach of, we didn't get these outcomes that we wanted in our GCSEs last year, so what we'll do is, we'll put a revision timetable in place in year 11 where the children have to go every single day to a different revision class for the last 3 months of year 11 or the last 5 months of year 11 or whatever it is. And to me, that's so back to front. That's you're closing the door after the horse has bolted there. Mm-hmm. Because what you really need to do is come back and think, right, where can we help them from year 7 to develop the habits of being an effective learner, and how can we support them in the time that we've got in the school day to start retaining more of this information? If that information is all lost, or a lot of it's lost by year 11, and you've got to spend all of the hours in the school day and tag on an extra hour at the end of the day and do an extra few revision days in the Easter holidays or whatever it is, something's going wrong there. Because you shouldn't be in that position of having to teach the stuff again in some respects. We need to go back to year 7, don't we, and start teaching them the skills of effective learning so that you're building something up, and you would hope that they don't have to do much revision. Like revision is just going over some of the things and checking you know it, not relearning it, re-remembering it, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I listened to something recently, and Doug Lemoff was speaking about the curriculum and the syllabus and how we often have an obsession as teachers that we have to get to the end of the syllabus. And he was saying that's often, or it can be, at the detriment of high quality teaching and learning, where learning sticks. And what's the point in motoring through the end of the syllabus if students are only retaining kind of 60% of what you're teaching them? Actually, is it not better to get to 85%, but they've smashed it and they've really achieved all of it? And I think that's such a good point. I think I wonder what we need as kind of educators, or what that gives us. Does that give us a sense of satisfaction that we've kind of like signed, sealed, delivered, regardless of how well learning has really stuck?
Because you never have to get 100%, do you, to get the top grade anyway?
Yeah.
When you look, it's never going to be. It's probably around at 85% probably that you would get a top grade, maybe 90. Yeah. But I was just going to say, it's true that's what I was thinking. A lot of some of the issues that I had, or challenges that I faced, or barriers, whatever you might call them, as a deputy head responsible for teaching and learning, was that a lot of the heads of department, not a lot, a few of the heads of department would say, well, I don't have time to do that because I've got to deliver all this content. Like, there's all this content to deliver. And my response was always, you can deliver the content, but it doesn't mean that they've learned it. You're actually sacrificing depth for breadth.
Yeah.
And that's not helpful
to the students. I think when we introduced effective effort, and we'd always talked around effort, but we'd kind of probably done that thing which we've all seen in different settings, where it's kind of like, good, you do your homework, you're going to get the best effort grade I can give you, you know, and in class, you work hard and you do what I ask you to do. And we really challenged ourselves as a group of academic leaders last year within the school. And we said, effort is way more than that. Like, we're kind of celebrating the wrong thing with effort there. And that's when we really looked at, effort is about being in your stretch zone. It's not about getting things right. It's actually about getting things wrong and learning. If you're really effective with your effort, you're really reflecting and you're constantly challenging yourself and setting new goals. You're taking that feedback that you're given and you're responding to it. You don't have to be asked to do it. You're naturally kind of looking at what your targets are. And you're really willing to make mistakes, and you understand that you embrace them and they're part of your learning journey. And we said, when we really reviewed that and we looked at that, and students were involved in that process as well, we said, we'll know we get this right when we've got teachers that are confident to give some of our top scoring students with really poor habits or poor learning habits low effort grades. You know, they're confident enough to say, yes, you're doing all right at the moment, but you're relying on kind of a base level of intelligence, but you're probably not going to be able to push through that unless you really focus on your effort and look more at the process. I think that has been really powerful for our students in particular, and just kind of tipping that balance a bit more.
I think one of the issues with process for outcome is that outcomes are so much easier to measure. A lot of the things that you're talking about are really difficult to pin down, you know, really difficult to put numbers to if you're a senior leader in a school. And if you're trying to evidence impact, I'm not saying this is the right way to do things, but I think in the UK or in England, where we've got high stakes accountability and we're constantly trying to evidence the impact, and that's why I think there's a lot of focus on outcomes, because I don't know if you can hear that, but that is the dog scratching around. She's going to sleep. She's settling down in the paper, but in the paper recycling bag. it's very, very loud and rustly. But it's easy to measure outcomes. So it's a really easy thing to say, well, let's focus on outcomes, because then we can measure how well our pupils have done. And the other work that you're doing
is a lot more difficult if it's skills based or effort based. And how do you standardize that so that everybody is measuring it in the same way, so that there's some sort of way of comparing? Does that make sense? Like it's just a lot easier to measure outcomes. So let's focus on the outcomes because we've got some numbers and we can look at percentages and we can compare with other schools, and it's just much more straightforward.
Yeah, and we are fortunate in that way, I suppose, in an international setting. Like, we don't have the same measures and comparisons that do exist in the UK. But I think what we do have is space to consider what does actually improve academic outcomes over time. We have that kind of space to think, right, what is it that's really needed? And a bit more space to kind of really look at how we can deliver that. And I think you just kind of mentioned that it's easy, but, and I'm sure we'll all agree as school leaders, but it's not right that you shouldn't be taking the easy route. You should be taking a route that's kind of really relevant to your context and really works for the students and the staff that are with you. There's a really great quote that I found. I'm currently studying my master's, not on Duolingo.
I'm not studying for a master's on Duolingo. I'm just
no,
just some conversational Spanish so that I can get by.
This person's not unlike one of our educationists that we'd know, but there's a really nice quote that says, in order to create an environment where every student maximizes their potential, schools need to shift the success focus away from achievement alone onto more nurturing and motivational indicators such as effort and incremental achievement. And I think, you know, when we can say as a school that we've got to that place, and as we've mentioned, you know, academic outcomes will come with us anyway and are likely to improve, then, you know, we can confidently say that we've kind of made it, and that we've done right by the students that we've got.
I mean, do the academic outcomes give you any useful information that you use to have an impact on the process approach that you take?
What do you mean by that?
So if you were to look at the outcomes of your pupils and you say, oh, well, we've got X number of pupils getting this grade or X number of pupils getting that grade, and there's a gap there, some of these pupils didn't quite achieve that. Do you still use that to feed into the work that you do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we still have a process where we look at that. But our intervention, and you mentioned intervention a little bit earlier, our intervention processes look across all of it. So I kind of lead on that side of the school and look at data, but it's not just looking at those academic outcomes. We kind of triangulate across three sets, and effort plays a big part in that.
And how
is that uncommon, really? But yeah, so it's all used.
And do you introduce parameters into it? Because one of the things that I find is, like, teaching is not something you can really, like, you can say a few things that makes good teaching. Like, I can identify, you know, it's got a real clear learning, the lesson's got a really clear learning outcome, and that's shared with pupils and they know where they are at each point in the lesson, and there'd be effective questioning and it'd be a lesson that made the pupils think and blah blah. But like, I just think when people used to say to me, well, what's an outstanding lesson look like? I just feel like, well, it looks like something that I see and know, that this is really great learning that's taking place in front of me. And it's not something you can pin down and put in a list and say, if you do these 12 things, that equals an outstanding lesson. And that's what people want. Yeah. They want those lists. They want the check box so they can go, okay, I've done that. Do you in any way sort of set the parameters for effort or for the, you know, the metacognition? Do you say, like, well, with effort we're looking for these things so that teachers can use that as a guide and then you can use that as a way of measuring it?
Yeah, I'm going to do a little interlude if that's okay, and then I'll come back to that question, I promise. But I that the outstanding word, I definitely would answer the question, but the outstanding word really reminded me of a conversation I had when I was in the UK. And I was one of those teachers that was identified as being one of the outstanding teachers in the school and didn't really get it. Like, you know, yes, I kind of care and I'm doing these things, but like, see me on a wet Wednesday when I've got seven whatever and it's a very different thing. And I did, you know, I worked in the UK when actually there was a bit of a formula, and I think, you know, I'm relatively bright, I understand those sorts of things, and if you ask me to do something, I'll do it. So yes, I was identified as an outstanding teacher, but there was a toolkit and I used it. But I remember we had some sort of kind of internal inspection or something, and I was on duty with the assistant head, responsible for teaching and learning, who was great. And no, I remember what happened. We'd had some sort of inspection and then she'd been in, and you know, when they always fed back to you and basically they just told you what grade you were.
Yeah.
And then it didn't matter what the feedback was anyway, because you knew that you were whatever grade you'd been given. And for me, there'd been this sort of inspection thing happening, and I'd been really worried and I was convinced I wasn't going to be outstanding again. And then she'd come in and said, oh, it was outstanding. Anyway, a few weeks later, the deputy head observed me. And I tried something different. I can't remember what it was. And I do actually remember what it was. I was trying to teach them how to break the rules of portraiture before I taught them what the rules of portraiture were. Anyway, it was a disaster, and he was in the room and it wasn't great. And anyway, I went down to his office whenever I went down and we chatted through it. And he said, like, I know you're a great teacher, but it wasn't great. I didn't see it. And I said, no, yeah, I know. And so we ended up talking. And anyway, in the end, he said, I think it was a three. I think Steph, probably it's an it requires improvement. And I went out on break duty with the assistant head teaching and learning. And she must have known. She almost looked like she was mortified that I'd fallen from grace. And she's like, Steph, are you okay? Like, how are you feeling? And I said, great. Like, I feel such the pressure to perform at that level, like, continuously is gone. And now I feel like I've tried something and I've taken a risk and it hasn't worked, but I've really listened to what feedback he's provided me with and I will use it. Whereas that doesn't normally happen. And I said, like, actually, if I were to be really honest, I feel like it's the best thing that could have happened to me. But I don't think we can all have that, because I think you only really get that confidence to say I'm cool with that if you've been told that you're doing all right in other areas.
But you know, the thing is, if I look back on my teaching, I could say, if you put in a label on it, which is ridiculous to start with, but I taught some outstanding lessons, and I might be what you describe as a good / outstanding teacher, but I taught some shit lessons. Yeah. I there'd be lessons where I'd just think, oh my god, that was a disaster. Mm-hmm. It didn't go well. And if someone had been watching me, I would have been inadequate or RI. And I don't think there's anybody out there who can say they've never had lessons like that. And that, like you're saying, over the course of a week, dependent on external factors, weather, how you're feeling, how the kids are feeling, what's going on in the school, like, you're up and down. You're not consistently performing at that high level, you know. Yeah. But the point with it is that what you took from that was a conversation about how you could do things differently and do things better. That's why I think a coaching approach to lessons and talking about lesson observations are stupid anyway, because no one ever behaves the same when they're being observed. So you don't actually see what someone's doing on a day-to-day basis. I've worked with members of staff who Ofsted have said, oh, there was some outstanding practice in English when this teacher did that. And my experience of that teacher was, well, she's not doing that on a day-to-day basis. Day-to-day, mm-hmm. She's probably RI, but she can turn it on like that when Ofsted come in. So for me, it's more about having a coaching approach that creates an environment in which staff can do what you're encouraging the kids to do, which is to think about the process of what they're doing and to start thinking about it intellectually and to start reflecting on it for themselves so that they can change their own practices and they can identify what they want to achieve in their lesson, but they can come back and have a person who can reflect some things back to them about how the children responded to the work that was presented to them in the lesson. And then that is a point of learning for that person moving forward. And it's a similar thing, like I always say, whatever works with the kids works with the staff. If you do this to build relationships with the kids, then in a bit more of a grown-up way, you do exactly the same thing with the staff. And it sounds like, you know, what you're doing with the children, you need to do with the staff, because they have to recognize that they're learners as well. I don't know if you do any of that sort of work with the staff.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring this up, because actually I was having a conversation around this afternoon, and it's a piece of work that we've been working on and I've kind of had my eye on for some time. When I moved into assistant head 4 years ago, or prior to moving in, actually, someone had said, "Oh, Steph, can we come and observe your lesson?" It was the head at the time, and I said, "Yeah, sure. What are you looking for? And what's going to serve our students best here?" And we didn't really have an idea about what it was. So we've worked on our kind of statements of excellence, which does answer the question that you asked me that I didn't forget about, which is just kind of like making
that was the sure question originally, but it's
that's just making sure that what we're trying to value and that we're trying to push with the students, we're also trying to develop and engender within those teaching and learning approaches as well. And it was really interesting because the school hadn't really had that before. We're a young school anyway, you know, a lot of the work that I've been doing has been like building systems and things like that. And so people had worked on this. It was a collaborative approach. Teachers from kind of nursery up to IB teachers collaborated. They had one of these statements for the year. They explored it. They looked at how it would work. And then we had it after a year. We kind of had this statements of excellence kind of framework, I suppose. Not a kind of nothing around grading. Just like, if you're doing questioning in our context, this is what we're aspiring to do. And people were terrified of it. You know, it was a real, people were so concerned about it, even though we weren't, you know, we were using it. We wanted to use it as a toolkit, really, to kind of have productive conversations around teaching and learning. And so it has taken a good few years of just bringing those in and embedding them slowly and trying to reduce down some of that noise, I think, that we've just talked around like the grading culture that perhaps if we've taught in the UK or in England, we're kind of familiar with. Got a bit of trauma from perhaps, and we're just now looking at how we move. So we've kind of really slowly embedded that, really, because we've been conscious of how it's been making people feel, and we're just at a point now where we are starting to say, like, right, we need to be really clear about like what diet of feedback we are providing for people, but not feedback in the way that we we're used to hearing it, you know, in that kind of coaching conversations. We want to make it, we kind of had this approach to date that's been our looking at learning fortnights, that's been more like working with your peers and working within your departments. And it's been at the beginning, at the end of the year, and never time-wise, we've never quite got it quite right. So now we're saying to heads of department, right, we want you to make these promises, this kind of commitment about developing a cycle in your department where people are having conversations around their practice and it doesn't feel judgmental, and it does start to move things forward in line with our statements of excellence. Now, I don't think anything that I've just said is particularly maverick, and I think probably, you know, most schools in our setting are working in a similar way. But I do think it was really interesting in that, you know, at the same time as kind of doing this work with students, we've been doing it with staff a little bit as well and kind of getting them to focus, but it's taken time. And I think when you commit to these sorts of changes, you have to know it's going to take a while and that things aren't going to change overnight. And now people are really kind of hungry for it. And they are saying to us at exit interviews, like, I want to be developed a little bit more within my classroom practice, or, you know, I'd really like it if I can connect with these people. And actually, from my perspective, I've always been like, yeah, you can go ahead and connect with them. But I think actually people just needed to be told that sort of approach was okay.
So
I'm excited about that. But I think all of that comes from our leadership, doesn't it? And making sure that we're moving at the right pace, but we're also being a bit vulnerable in our own leadership and being a bit imperfect at times and showing that, you know, we're at the bottom of the pit, or that we've develop the skills to kind of help ourselves get out of the pit.
And I think that you have to be cautious. I know you've got your statements of excellence. You do have to be cautious with things like that, because what you don't want is to create an environment where people are just teaching by numbers. You know, you want people to be allowed to be creative and enjoy what they're doing and not just feel like they're trying to do all these things that you've got on a tick list. You know, that's not what success is about in teaching, is it?
Absolutely.
So I don't know if people really know what metacognition means. It's a word that's, you know, thrown around and like, oh, focus on metacognition, and if you do, then, you know, it's about learning how you learn, isn't it? But what do you understand metacognition to be, and how have you translated that from something which is quite maybe a bit abstract into something that's really practical and applicable through the teaching in your school?
I think we've probably talked through some of the strategies that we've used to break metacognition down. And when I started this work in the UK, I didn't know that it was metacognition either. Just kind of knew that discussing the learning process is really important, and the forgetting curve, and understanding that I need to go back to information and look at retrieval practice and embed that into my practice, or encourage students to do the same. So I don't know whether I've got a perfect answer to this, which is okay, right?
Yeah, it's fine. But, I love the imperfect.
But I think just some of the strategies that we've embedded. So yeah, looking at our effective effort and saying that we really value that process side of things. I think some of the things that we've talked around in terms of report, reflection of course is really key. We've barely kind of touched on reflection today, but I think really getting students to really understand that, and making sure that our teachers really understand how to effectively reflect as well. I think it's really easy to say do your reflections, but kind of what does that look like? And we're really fortunate in the school because, you know, we're an IB school and we deliver the CAS program, and our CAS coordinator has really looked at how she can embed reflection in many, many different ways within her curriculum, but then has kind of fed that out into the wider school community. And she's really changed the narrative around reflection not being about written responses in
red pen time, the purple pen of progress, etc.
Yeah. So she's really looked at that, and she's actually been really visual with that. So now we kind of have common kind of visuals across the school that people are using to make sure that students are actually reflecting rather than answering a question because you've told them that you've got to answer a question. So I think that cultural shift has been really positive as well.
Are there different elements to reflection then? Do you reflect in different ways? Do you teach the children like reflection means all these things?
I'd say we teach reflection using different tools, and so right. As a consequence, they can then, as they move through the school, start to understand when's best to use the reflection wheel, or when it's best to have a coaching conversation with the person next to you and get you, you know, and reflect a bit more deeply there. So I think that process has been really a lot more organic, though. There's been some kind of champions within the school that have said, oh, I'm finding this really valuable. Can I kind of share what I'm doing with everyone else? But reflection is one of the, going back to our assessment approach at Key Stage 3, reflection is one of the strands that we have kind of pushed on as well. So I suppose we've kind of formalized what we expect to see really good reflection to be.
No, speaking about reflection as well, I think that's what makes coaching so powerful too, because it provides an opportunity in a space. This is what so many people, like head teachers, school leaders who I talk to, say, that it provides that space to reflect on something that you've done and how you could improve on it and potentially do things differently. And you mentioned that sort of the being in the pit. And I think before we started talking, you referred to that and how coaching got you out of that place. So I'm just interested because I'm really nosy. I just really love to hear about what the pit was and how you got yourself out of it. And I'm always, you know, one of coaching's top advocates. Yeah. So any evidence from you in terms of how coaching has supported you? Because I think people don't realize or understand the benefits of coaching sometimes until they've experienced it. But unless they experience it, they don't understand like how much value there is to it, and they're not necessarily prepared to invest in it because they don't really know the power of it and how it can really have an impact on outcomes for them. So can you take us through that coaching process, how that happened and what you gained from it?
Yeah, of course. I was actually listening to one of your previous episodes recently, and I think it might have been you that said I've spent a fortune on coaching within my lifetime, and I don't regret any of it, and I feel really similarly. So I 2 years ago, kind of mid pandemic, still here, almost all members of the secondary leadership team and the whole school leadership team just consequentially all kind of left. And so there were a couple of members of the leadership team remaining, and I was super excited about it. You know, I thought it'd be a really good and a great opportunity for the school. And I speak really openly about this experience that I've had with coaching with staff as much as I can, really, and students, because I think it's really powerful. I was really excited, and we started the school year virtually, which was, you know, a challenge. We'd kind of only had a small bit of virtual here. And then when the UK had kind of been shut down, we were open, and then we had like a year. So we were bringing up the tail end of kind of COVID when everyone else had moved on and forgotten that it existed almost. And so we started virtually. And I think I was just so excited to have a new team, to have new people to be inspired by and work by. And so I went through nearly the whole school year, and I got to a point in school year and I was thinking, oh no, like this isn't the fun I thought it was going to be. This is really hard and really challenging. And I'm finding myself being a bit defensive here. Like I'm finding myself, I definitely wasn't trying to be that, like, well, we've done that before, or we've tried that before and it doesn't work approach. But I couldn't quite find my place, and I was kind of struggling, and my confidence just took like a bit of a downward spiral. And I didn't know that at the time, though, really. I just wasn't having a particularly fun time. And I eventually thought, like, this isn't about anyone else. This isn't about a change in leadership. This is about me, and this is about me trying to, I need to kind of find a way of like shifting my mindset and getting my confidence back, and just making sure that, you know, I feel right about the decisions that I'm making, and I don't need to feel like I need to go and, you know, need external support or you know, I need to go to my line manager about these things all the time. I should be able to make calls and that, and I am able to. So I came home last summer, and then I, on my return to Vietnam, I was like, I'm going to reach out to a coach. And I hadn't really heard many people talk about coaching. And then, of course, once you experience it, you feel like that's the only thing that people are talking about. And I just had an absolutely incredible experience. And I think I went into it at the right time. I went into it with the right mindset. And I knew it was about me, and I knew I needed to kind of shift some of my thinking and my behaviors and the way that I was, information was kind of landing with me. And worked with an excellent lady who lives in, you know, relatively close in regions, so kind of gets the international context as well, and is also a school leader. And she just helped me to kind of work through some things. And it really didn't take long for me to kind of start to develop my own tools to kind of get out of the pit. And I think when I was in the pit, I was thinking, why isn't anyone helping me? Why isn't anyone else bigging me up? Like, surely someone can see that I'm struggling a little bit. And then, of course, when I came out the other side, I realized that I was the only person that could fix it and develop the skills to make it better. And now I still work with a coach, with the same coach now, and but for very different reasons. And I feel so grateful for that experience now. Not necessarily the coaching one. I mean, absolutely that. But the fact that I went through that really challenging period and then knew what to do in order to kind of get out of it and work through it.
It sounds like you were heading towards a burnout there.
Yeah, I think I probably was. But I think probably at the time I was talking around workload, but I think probably more it was like the thoughts that were occupying my head and like the thinking that I was doing that was taking time and space and was a bit exhausting.
It was
a really great experience, and something that I, you know, myself and the head of secondary have talked loads about how we bring coaching into school and how we. And I think the more that I've kind of spoken about my experiences and how positive it's been, the more that I've noticed that people in school are asking for these opportunities. And so as we move into next year, we're going to start with like a small cohort of staff that are kind of putting their hands up and saying, like, I want to be better at this, rather than this kind of blanket approach that everyone's got to do some coaching training. They're not kind of buying into it. And then we're going to kind of grow it organically.
And I think that that's what you have to do if you're going to create a coaching culture in your school, is it has to be voluntary. People have to ask for it, or people have to say, you can say, this is on offer, who wants to take advantage of it? And you go with the people who do, because if you impose it, that's not coaching anyway, because coaching is self-directed. So if someone's thought, oh, I don't really want to do this, it's not, I'm not saying it can't work, but it's unlikely to work. And you create, I think when you're building a culture, it starts small with early adopters. And then when they find it really beneficial, they will describe their experience to other people who go, oh, that sounds interesting, actually, maybe I would like to do that. But I think it starts with senior leaders as well. You have to, your senior leaders have to be coached. They have to buy into it. They have to understand what coaching is. They have to have been coached, rather than just saying, oh, I think everybody would benefit from coaching, I don't have time myself, but you know, it'd be good for you. It's never going to work that way. And it's a drip feed. It's a start small, and it's going to take you a few years to do it.
Yeah, and I think I'm really conscious of that the way that we're doing it and we want to do it, and you know, both myself and the head of secondary really align on this, that we want it to be a bit of an organic process, and so we know it's going to take time. I'm really conscious that there are people in the building that kind of would like a little bit more for themselves at the moment, and I've been really fortunate. I've been mentoring through a women's network here. I've been mentoring to people that work in different schools. And I have loved that process so much. I actually did it so that I could, felt like I was giving a bit back, because I wanted to be able to open the opportunity to a few people in school that were kind of asking for that sort of thing. And I have loved the experience. And I have such a good time with our mentoring sessions when I'm mentoring. And I kind of was a bit worried, because I was like, I've had some coaching training, like I know how coaching works, but I don't really know how mentoring, what it looks like. And that's been excellent, and I've really enjoyed those relationships, and actually that's encouraged me. The school that I work in is a part of a bigger group. There's many schools, but there's four in Vietnam, and then there's, you know, lots of different schools in the region as well. And so I've been working with other schools, and I'm really keen from the start of next year that we offer a mentoring program as our coaching culture kind of develops. So we're going to look at, you know, again, just people that want it, that kind of putting their hand up for things. We'll get some mentors trained up. It's about, you know, professional dialogue, but I think just someone outside of the building to talk to about ideas around, with kind of have conversations with, will be really powerful as we're growing the coaching program. So I'm really excited about that, and I just think we have to be really creative as leaders, because we can't, you know, we can't afford realistically for absolutely everyone to have their own personal coach. I think we have to really think about how we can create that opportunity instead.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I think you've given an example really of something that I think is so important, and that is that we can do things differently. We can take different approaches. We don't have to do things the way they've always been done. And the importance of that, recognizing that the process is actually what we need to focus on, not the outcome, is really important. So thank you so much. What would you say to people, just to finish, who say, well, that's okay because you're in an international school and we're in schools in England, let's say England, because it is slightly different in England, and that's maybe not going to work for us?
Yeah, and I have been thinking that, actually, just as you were doing a little summary there, I was thinking it's a very fortunate position to be in, because we're also a school that has relatively good academic outcomes. And so we do have that space, and we don't have that pressure to be able to do that. You know, that piece of work has already been done. But if we go back to the EEF, if we go back to those kind of months of progression, and I've seen this in the UK, you know, I worked in the UK for 10 years and led some of this work and saw academic outcomes fly. But there's huge pressures, and I think it's very easy to to think that the most important thing, or the thing that you, it's kind of that reactive, proactive approach, isn't it? And you've mentioned this earlier, but if you can try and find the space to look a bit more proactively and think about your year sevens and think about what you want your year sevens to be doing by the time they're in year 11. And if you can't do it as a senior leader, then find a really excited and motivated younger teacher that wants to, you know, try something new and invest a little bit in them in terms of knowledge and give it to them and try and get them to focus on it.
But, and have your outcomes improved since you've changed the approach? Well, since you've introduced this approach?
Yeah, it is. That is a really interesting question, because our effective effort is now kind of about to come to the end of its second year. So I suppose that will be telling in terms of our academic outcomes this year. And our key stage three assessment approach is now in its fourth year. So I suppose what I've just said, those kind of grassroots are now starting to come through. But yes, like academics outcomes have improved each year. We could suggest that it is linked to this, but I think there's a lot of, we've talked around so many different strategies today, and I think all of those hopefully will have played some sort of part in that too.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. If people wanted to find out more about sort of what you're doing, or they wanted to ask you any questions, is there any way that they could get in touch with you?
Yes, of course. I actually am normally quite active on Twitter, but it's the end of term and I've not said a word in months. I've got two more get-ups and then it's my summer holiday beginning. I am at Hanoi Deputy Head on Twitter.
Well, and people can just, I suppose, tweet you there.
Drop me a message.
If they would like to, drop you a message.
Happy to share anything I can.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Steph.
Take care.
Isn't Stephanie great? I absolutely loved that interview. It was just fascinating hearing about all the different ways that she's focused on process over outcome, not least how they focused on metacognition, which I think is really a way forward for many schools when it comes to teaching and learning. Anyway, that's all we've got time for today. So if you want to get in touch with me about any of the coaching that I offer, or even if you'd just like to have a chat with me about coaching and what that could be like for you, what it could offer you in your school, I'd be very happy to have a chat with you. You can book in for a chat with me on my website, which is www.weleadwell.co.uk. There I go, being a boomer again. You don't need the www anymore, do you? Or you can email me. It's vicky@weleadwell.co.uk. And if you want to look into buying your supply cover insurance with Schools UK, don't forget to go on their website and you can use the code WeLeadWellPodcast for a 10% discount. That's all we've got time for today. So have a great week, whatever you are doing. Enjoy the sunshine, although it feels like the weather's broken a little bit and we might be getting some rain this week, but whatever you're doing, enjoy it. Take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Progressive Masculinity and Head Teacher Chat.